Okay, welcome to Public Health 241. This is lecture 14, but it's not February 19th, February 22nd. We started this on Friday, and now we're going to continue. And then, as I indicated on the B-Space, Paul Chafee and Maya Peterson, I think you'll enjoy both of them. They're very different, but both of them have experience with this material. And they will come in and talk about this. This is my favorite week, so I'm a little disappointed not to be here for some of these lectures, but unfortunately I have to travel. Okay, so last time we talked about, now that we have some tools for making inference about associations, albeit in simple situations with binary risk factors, which we'll soon generalize to much more complicated scenarios, but the basic ideas aren't going to change, and we have those tools in our toolbox. What do they tell us about causation, and are they really addressing the question at hand, or are we sort of mindlessly and blindly following a statistics professor down a track of learning technical tools, but they don't actually mean anything? So this is the lecture where we really try and address that question. Does it really mean anything? And we talked about the causation issue, and we don't really know if from the data at hand, the way we've presented it and the methods we've used, whether pancreatic cancer is actually causing coffee drinking somewhere along its line or the other way around. And if you get into obviously that raises the temporal issue in causation, that you'd like the cause to precede temporally the outcome. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense to think something in the future caused something in the past unless you go into the Matrix land or one of those science fiction worlds where things in the future affect things in the past. So I'm not going there. But even in there, you know, it could be that when you start developing pancreatic cancer, maybe it starts very early on and it takes a long latency period, and instantly it starts. It sets off a craving for coffee, and you start that when you're in your 20s, not knowing that that's actually a consequence of something starting that's going to lead on the average to pancreatic cancer 30 years later. So it can be very difficult, logically, to figure out causation just from the kind of data we're looking at. And that's what we're going to try and do today. And it's going to be new to some of you and maybe not to others. So, and the idea is to try and think, if you just stop and think, what information would I like to know that coffee drinking is causing pancreatic cancer? So if I laid aside constraints of resources and so on, and this is not really a statistical question per se, because if I had the entire population instead of a sample of the kind we've been talking about, we still would have the same issue. We could still compute odds ratios, but we wouldn't really know if they're reflecting a causation in one direction or the other or some other common cause. So this is not really a statistical question. So I'm wandering off of statistics a little bit. But the way I address it is, what data or information would I like? And when I first was thinking about this a long time ago, I happened to have seen a movie. You can tell I like movies because I talk about them a little bit. And I happened to see a really interesting movie with Daniel Day-Lewis, who's just a brilliant, I guess he's Irish, actor. I love the Irish because my middle name, I'm a quarter Irish, so that's the P of my middle name. Now you know what it stands for, right? A brilliant movie called The Unbearable Lightness of Being. How many people have seen that movie? It's kind of old now, right? It's just the book is actually more interesting than the movie. But the movie's pretty good. I'm trying to remember the woman who's in it. Was it Uma Thurman that was in it? Or Lena Olin? I get them confused for some reason. So, you know, when you're at the stage in life when you're making life determining decisions, one of which might be who you're going to live with as a partner, hopefully for the rest of your life. Right? Some of you have made that decision. I've made it, but some of you have made it. But many of you probably haven't, because you're at the age when you're sort of at that point in life. And, you know, that's what the book is sort of about, is when you're making that choice, Kundera argues, well, look, if God were really fair, if you're asking, if I live with this woman or this man for the rest of my life, am I going to be happy, or would I be happier with this other woman, or maybe many women, or maybe no women, which would make me happier? If God were really fair, he'd let you live the life with the person that you picked now, and then he'd let you live it again without her. And then you could make a good decision, right? It's unfair. You're asked to make this decision about choosing between possible partners or whether you have one or not or whatever, what career. And you don't have any data. You're not allowed to run the experiment of saying, well, I'll see what happens when I set the conditions to living with this person, then I'll remove that person and I'll be able to know, oh, I was really a lot happier when I was living with her than not. And that's what Kundera calls the unbearable lightness of being, because you only have one life and you don't even get to live that life and then make the decision. You don't get to look ahead and say, oh, I can see this relationship is going to be an absolute disaster. I'm not going to go there. You have to make the decision before you have any data. And that's what the unbearable lightness of being is about, that you have to make these decisions and God is really unfair, or whoever the powers are, that only give you one life. Imagine you really could run two lives. Wouldn't you like to do that? If you're just caught on that decision, should I go this way for my career? Should I choose this person? Whatever the big life decisions are, wouldn't you really like to be able to live the life twice and then sort of make the decision based on the data you collect? And you'd make a rational decision. It's just irrational to decide with very little data, but that's what we have to. So that's what, when I happened to be thinking about this and I saw this movie and I read the book and I started thinking about this, that tied me into this literature around here of counterfactuals, which is, wouldn't it be nice if we could run the experiment when everyone drinks coffee and we see how many people get pancreatic cancer in this whatever population I'm interested in. Then we get to give them another life and we keep everything else the same, but we don't let them drink coffee. And then we just see how many get pancreatic cancer in the first scenario and how many in the second scenario. Of course, as soon as you see it that way, that's exactly what you probably did back in high school when you did a science fair experiment, or when you're in the physics lab and you're wondering what's the effect of temperature on a chemical reaction. You set up the chemistry experiment, you have the temperature set at one thing, you measure some output, some measure of a reaction, either time or output, and then you go back and run an identical experiment, everything else being the same except you turn the temperature up 20 degrees, and then you do it again, you turn it up 30 degrees, and then you do your little plots, right? And you put it on nice little graph paper, and you know, your high school teacher is happy. So that's what we'd like to do, and that's what we do in science when we have the ability to control and to run experiments in identical situations, just modifying one factor. And that's the real thing that defines experimentation, is that you have the investigator has the control over all the factors and can influence them at will, and then just change them one at a time and see what happens. That's what we do when we run modeling experiments on infectious diseases and try and decide what would happen if this model were correct, if 10% of the population were vaccinated at random. What would happen if 50% were vaccinated at random? And then you run them all. So you're running a modeling experiment. But that reflects, that's what we'd really like to do. So that's what we would like to do now. So now let's try and envisage what the data would look like if we were allowed to do that. Now you have to go into this other land where you're at the moment you're suspending belief that, well, we can't ever have two lives in the epidemiologic setting. For some of you, you might be imagining applications where you really could do this. But for many experiments with humans, particularly, you can't, because if the experiment involves destruction in the sense of a fatal disease, you don't get to see them again. But anyway, let's imagine what would happen. So let's suppose we took a population, let's just, if you want, think this class, and I got you at birth or early age and said, I am going to force feed you coffee. You have to drink coffee. And I could set the dose. I'm the investigator. You're going to drink one cup of coffee a day, or whatever the exposure is, in this case, coffee drinking. And I force you to do it. Let's leave the ethics aside. You live your life, but all you do is you're a coffee drinker. You know, I'll have to drink a cup of coffee a day. And then I measure you throughout your life and see whether you develop pancreatic cancer. And then, because I've been so unkind to you by forcing this on you, I get to give you another life, the condition being I also get to choose your coffee drinking habits in your second life. Everything else is the same. Get the same parents, same education, same everything, same environment. But this time, you don't get to drink coffee right from the start. And then I watch and see what happens to you in this new experimental setting. Okay? Everyone with me? There's only four possibilities of what can happen. And these are the four possibilities in this table. You're either unfortunate enough that in both lives, whether you drink coffee or not, you end up getting pancreatic cancer. For whatever reason. Maybe there's some horrible gene that's picked up from your parents or something that's wrong. That's irrelevant. But you, under either condition, you end up getting this. And this will be very rare because it's a rare disease. But and then there are some people fortunate enough, and most of us are in the category, it doesn't make any whit of difference. Giving you coffee once a day or not doesn't make any difference. You end up completely pancreatic cancer-free and you're a D-bar in either experimental scenario. And then there are some people for which, in fact, you get a different response depending on the particular conditions. So these people in group two get pancreatic cancer when they're exposed to the coffee drinking in their lives, but they don't when they're not. And then, of course, there may be some people in reverse who only get it when they're not exposed to coffee. And that's the only four possibilities. There isn't any other if you could run this experiment. Okay. Now, let's imagine if we could run the experiment, we would know what you would know right now which of those four groups you're in. As I say, hopefully most of us are in group four. But in principle, if I were a supreme being looking ahead and able to run this experiment, I would know which of what characteristic you were, and you would have that label attached to you. So it would be inside. It's just no one else can see it. And in fact, that label is inside you right now. You just can't see it. No one can see it. But there is a label. You are either a one, a two, a three, or a four. Right? Because it is possible to imagine a life where you, if you're a coffee drinker, you will get some partial information as to which group is in, because you'll see your answer to the question, what happens to you when you drink coffee with regard to pancreatic cancer. You just won't know the answer to the other condition, and vice versa. But it's certainly plausible to believe, what if I hadn't chosen that to drink coffee? Would this have made a difference? So it's certainly plausible to believe you have that group assignment already determined, in a sense. Okay? And so in principle, in any population, if we knew this information, if we knew those labels, we could just count up how many people were in group one, the unfortunate ones who always get pancreatic cancer both their lives, seems like cruelty, and so on. So now we can actually do the comparison we'd really like to do. We can say what would be the incidence of pancreatic cancer in this population if everyone drank coffee, as compared to what would be the incidence in this population if no one drank coffee. And then we can compare those to quantify that by using all the tools we have, like relative risk or odds ratios, or doesn't matter, excess risks. So here's a relative risk, and I've labeled it as causal, because at this point it's referring to this sort of super data that means we have to see everyone live twice under exactly the same experimental conditions except their coffee drinking habit. And you can see that under the population when everyone is exposed to coffee drinking, NP1 plus NP2 get pancreatic cancer. Because in the situation where everyone drinks coffee, only if you carry this label 1 or 2 do you get pancreatic cancer. And there's NP1 plus NP2 of you. So the incidence under coffee drinking is NP1 plus NP2. And the incidence under no coffee drinking, so there's the number who get it in the population of size N under coffee drinking. Similarly, if you imagine looking at the entire population when no one drinks coffee, the number who get pancreatic cancer is NP1 plus NP3, right? And if you take the ratio of those two, all the N's cancel, so it's not dependent on the size of the population. The relative risk comparing those two incidences are P1 plus P2 divided by P1 plus P3. Now, we're still suspending belief. We know we can never see this label because we never see anyone in two experimental conditions. But that's what we would ultimately, I think, really like to see. Then we'd know the only difference between these two incidences is that in one case, everyone drank coffee, in the other case, no one drank coffee. Everything else was the same. So anything that coffee drinking causes after it that you change, that's a cause of coffee drinking. If you make other changes because you're deprived of coffee in this experimental setting, well, and that leads to pancreatic cancer, that's part of the cause of causal pathway of not drinking coffee. Anyone want to argue against that? Okay. By the way, so what do you see about this? As I say, for every individual that you study, you get to see half of your response, because for some of you who are non-coffee drinkers, we get to see whether you're a D or D bar, and those of you who are coffee drinkers, we get to see your D and your D bar, but we never get to see the other counterfactual. What would have happened if, counter to fact, you hadn't drunk coffee, or vice versa? We don't never get to see that. That's the unbearable lightness of being. That's the what if in life. You never get to see it. You'll never know. And so the question now out there is, to what extent from the data we can see, where we're only seeing sort of half of the response for any given individual, we're only seeing you under one experimental condition, under what situation can we extrapolate from that information to tell us about this, what we would have estimated if we'd seen you under both? That's basically the problem now, statistically. This is what we'd like in a world where we had unlimited ability to dispense multiple lives to you. Can we infer anything about this from the data we actually get? So let's see. That's the question I now pose. And I'm now going to try out just what I often do is just try some examples to see, can I learn anything? So imagine a world in where, for whatever reasons, let's not discuss that, group one individuals, so remember you've got that label inside, you don't know it, no one will know it, because you'll only ever know, even when you die, you won't know it, even if you die from pancreatic cancer, you won't know what would have happened had I done something else with coffee. But imagine group one individuals are always coffee drinkers. So the people who have that label one written inside their skin in a way you can't see, but they're group ones, imagine they always drink coffee for whatever reason. And similarly, group three always do, but group two and group four do the reverse. They always abstain from coffee drinking. We don't see this process because we don't see the label, but that's just the way the world is. Group one and three individuals turn out always to be coffee, and we always see their coffee drinking condition. That's what we see for them, but for group two and group four individuals, we always see them under the non-coffee drinking scenario. Then what does the data generated in the population actually look like? Well, you can see by looking at the counterfactuals, if you go back to the table here, what do you see in, you know, we're going to look at a table on the next slide of the kind we've been looking at, where we look at a population and we have D, D bar, and E, E bar. So how, given this assumption, how many people do we see who drink coffee who get pancreatic cancer? Well, the only people who drink coffee are group one and group three individuals, and only the group one individuals get pancreatic cancer. So the only people we see who drink coffee and get pancreatic cancer are group one individuals, and there's NP1 of them. So we can start filling in this table. So that'll be NP1 in the population. How about people who drink coffee and don't get pancreatic cancer? Well, again, only group one and group three drink coffee, and it's only the group three that don't get pancreatic cancer, so that's NP3, and so on. You can fill in the boxes yourself. There it is. I've done it for you. As it happens, there's no one in there, if that's the case, you'll ever observe not drinking coffee and getting pancreatic cancer. And there's the rest of the boxes filled in. And now, if you try and compute a relative risk or NOS ratio from the whole population, forget sampling, and having to estimate it, the odds ratio and the relative risk from this table is infinite. That's because you never see any pancreatic person, cancer victim, who hasn't drunk coffee. There are none. There's none in the population. So you see a relative risk of infinity, an odds ratio infinity. Maybe that's the truth, but that's what you will see. And that's what you will see, in fact, whatever the relative risk and odds ratio is down here. Whatever those P1, P2, P3, and P4s are that make up these numbers, whatever they are, if this assumption is correct, you will always see in your data a very large or infinitely large odds ratio. And you will always make the inference that, oh, coffee drinking causes pancreatic cancer. Whatever the truth is in the P1, P2, P3, P4 world. Okay, that's a little troubling. Let's just change the assumption. Suppose group 1 and group 2 individuals are always abstainers, and group 3 and group 4 individuals always drink coffee. So I just fiddled with the assumptions here of who actually, which condition you get to see for individuals in these different groups. Well, you can fill in the boxes again, and I won't go through the details of that, but it's trivial. You can fill in those boxes, and now there's a zero in there. You never see anyone who drinks coffee getting pancreatic cancer, right? Because the only people who drink coffee are group 3 and group 4 individuals, and they never get pancreatic cancer when they drink coffee. So you never see anyone who drinks coffee getting pancreatic cancer. Same idea, just in reverse. You get this table, so the odds ratio you will actually get to see, or I will, as an epidemiologist or statistician, will always look something like this. And the odds ratio is zero, where I'm going to come to the inference that coffee drinking is terrific. Everyone should be drinking coffee. Because you never get pancreatic cancer when you drink coffee. And again, independently of what these P1, P2, P3, and P4 actually are. So whatever the P1, the actual distribution of these groups of individuals are in the population, depending on what kind of coffee drinking habits are associated with their group membership, you could get anything from an odds ratio that's very large to an odds ratio that's very small. So how can I make inference from what I see, one of these tables, this one, or any others like it, how can I make inference about these quantities? Because whatever these quantities are, I can imagine scenarios that will produce data where I get a very large odds ratio, a very small odds ratio, or anywhere in between for that matter. So what this is telling us is that what we see in the real world, where we only get to observe people under one experimental condition, is apparently completely unrelated to the results we would have seen had we seen the full counterfactual picture, people under two conditions, which is what we really would like. In a nutshell, what we see from a case control study or cohort study, doesn't matter what kind of design, has really nothing to do, at least at first blush, with what we'd really like to know, which is, are these guys? So it has nothing to do with the causation of really comparing populations under two experimental conditions. So everything I've described, and a lot of you, it was review, and I could see a little people saying, oh, we know all this stuff, because we've learned it in some other course. So all those weeks you've learned about odds ratios on all those problem sets up to now, and all the work you've ever done, and all the papers you've ever read, actually have nothing to say about what's really going on if you were to allow yourself the world where you were able to expose populations to two different exposure scenarios. Nothing to say. As I said, it's not just that it varies a little bit depending on assumption. It can go from infinity to zero. So I quit. I confess. Everything I've said is just meaningless. It has nothing to do with causation. So what's the point? I think I should just walk out now and give up. Because it has nothing to say. It's just a total waste of time. It's exactly everything that you fear about statistics. It's just manipulating numbers. And when you actually go to interpret, you can interpret the same number as this could be happening, or the complete polar opposite could be happening and it leads to the same number. How many times have you seen that in political debates? The candidates have exactly the same numbers and one says, this is evidence that we're taxing people way too much. And then the same next candidate says, oh, no, no, this exact same data point means we're taxing people way too little. And then you think, what do? You turn off politics, right? Because you're saying, how can I tell the difference? It's all faith. Which one looks cuter is what I end up picking, right? But it's not meaningful. They're interpreting completely different causation factors leading to the same data. So how am I supposed to know? Well, that's exactly the situation we're in here, and it just seems pointless. And at other times when I've taught this, I have actually walked out the room and then left people sort of wondering, did he completely lose it? Then I walk back in again. Then I go like, American cultural references are dated now, but Columbo was the police program that used to be on TV here when I first came to the United States. Many of you won't remember it with Peter Falk, but he would always ask these questions and he'd say, oh no, of course you're innocent. I understand everything. And he'd go off camera and then he'd come back in his little raincoat and he'd say, just one last question, just something that's bothering me. So this is where I walk back in and say, wait, just before we quit and say the class is over, is there any situation where, in fact, we could be guaranteed that the results from data we see in the real world actually do give you information about the counterfactual world that we'd like to see? Is there any scenario under where that could be true? And here's the scenario, and this is the sort of where Columbus raises one thing. Imagine people choose coffee at random. So their parents or the person themselves tosses a coin at some point and says, if it's heads, you're going to be a coffee drinker. If it's tails, you're not. Now, again, that's not the way you decide to drink coffee, and that's going to be a problem. But just imagine a world where the exposure was actually determined for you at random. And there are some situations where that could be genetic conditions, right? It's decided, in a sense, at random by a toss of a coin, which allele you get from which parent. So you can imagine this scenario for certain exposures where this actually could be how it's done. So just imagine that. So that means of the group one, let's suppose we take a fair coin, doesn't have to be a fair coin, but so 50% of the time, group one individuals will drink coffee at random, and 50% of the time they'll not drink coffee, and similarly for the other people. Now what happens to the table, if you go through this and create the next table, you get this. So NP1 plus NP2, that's the total, and then the halves coming in from that tossing a coin. So if you want to see how you fill in those boxes, you know, of the group one, half of them will drink coffee, so that's NP1 over 2, and they will get the pancreatic cancer. So NP1 over 2 you will see in the actual data getting pancreatic cancer and drinking coffee. And then NP2, half of them will drink coffee, and they'll also show up as pancreatic cancer cases because they're guaranteed to get it if they drink coffee. And so there'll be NP2 over 2 in that box. And that's the only box in the who drink coffee and get pancreatic cancer. And there they are, NP1 over 2 plus NP2 over 2. And you can fill in the rest of the boxes. And those halves are coming because this coin I'm tossing to determine your coffee drinking exposure is fair. It's 50-50. And then you can see all these things add up to capital N. So this is the table that you will then be sampling from when you come in. The exposure was determined at random, and you get to see the results under the particular experimental condition that's assigned to you. Now, if you compute the odds ratio and the relative risk from this table, they exactly agree with the odds ratio and the relative risk that we would have gotten from the table where we saw the results under both conditions, in that beautiful counterfactual world where you get to live at least twice. So that's odd. So there is one possibility. If exposures were randomly assigned, it actually doesn't need to be fair, doesn't need to be 50-50, but if they were randomly assigned, then by only seeing people under one experimental condition, I'm able to infer the results from the experiment if I'd seen them under both. That is the power of randomization. That is why your life, medical and clinical conditions, have been determined by random experiments. That's why the FDA requires randomization for clinical treatments. There's a situation where society has determined it is ethical to randomly assign you an exposure. And it's called a randomized clinical trial, and they genuinely randomize people and do this to half the group and something else to the other half. And they look at the difference because they know that the results from that experiment allow them to infer what that would have happened if they'd exposed people on two conditions to both treatment scenarios. So a randomized clinical trial is, in fact, a situation where you do exactly this, and this is exactly the reason you do it. Because you know then that the results you see can have a causal interpretation. So that the benefits of the drug are due to the drug itself, not due to something else. Or the harm of the drug is due to the drug, attributable, caused by the drug, not due to something else. So there's one scenario. And we've used it to the hilt in experimentation, this randomization. Problem is, it doesn't cover very much territory because you can't randomize cigarette smoking to people, or coffee drinking, or environmental exposures, or a whole bunch of other risk factors. You simply can't. It's just not ethical, or it's just not possible to ever do that experiment. You can do it to mice and rats, but you might even argue if that's ethical. Then they do. But you certainly can't do it to humans for either of those reasons or both. So this is good because it says if we're able to randomize exposure, we really can make causal interpretation using the tools we've had. The only problem is if we can't, now what? Now you might argue that, wait a minute, how can it possibly be that group one and group two individuals, which are defined by their outcomes, by the way, determine what their condition is? That's sort of almost like saying, it kind of is like the future is determining which condition you're seen under, right? Because this is sort of saying group one individuals are all abstainers. That's like saying I run the experiment, I see whether you get pancreatic cancer when you drink coffee or not, you get it under both conditions, so now I know you're group one. Now I go back and say the life I'm going to let people on Earth see you live is the one where you're an abstainer. Is it really possible that your group membership can determine which of the two lives we get to see? And at first, that seems implausible, but in fact, there's a whole variety of scenarios where that is, in fact, the case. And that's to do with the role of other factors. So let me go back just to that slide where I had that kind of assumption in there, like this kind of thing. What can happen is there are other conditions, other factors about you that influence which experimental condition we get to see, the one you actually experience. So imagine a situation where, just for the sake of argument, you're living in a culture where only women can drink coffee. It's forbidden for men to drink coffee. It's culturally unacceptable. And it's not so implausible. There are many things like that where it's pretty much women do one thing and men do another, and it's completely not allowed in reverse, right? Pretty much. So imagine that, just you were living in a culture like that. There may be such a culture, for all I know, in the world where coffee drinking has certain spiritual thing, and so only women are allowed to do it, part of their culture. Well, that means that women you'll always get to see under the coffee drinking and never any men. And suppose, just by happenstance, for completely unrelated reason, women have a much higher risk of pancreatic cancer than men. Then you will be seeing that the influence of sex or gender is effectively the same as saying that all group one or many, much higher chance of a group one or a group two individual being seen as a coffee drinker or not. Right? Because imagine that women get pancreatic cancer also, just again, and not too much in men. It's actually the opposite, I think. Men get pancreatic cancer at higher rates than women. But just imagine a world or a culture where that is. Then, of course, the group one individuals are all women, right? Because men can't get pancreatic cancer. Whatever they drink in coffee is irrelevant. They just don't get it. So women, some women who drink, who are the only ones who drink coffee, they're the only ones who get pancreatic cancer. So group one is all women, and so on. And you can go down these lists. And effectively, it's not producing exactly this, but that role of another extraneous factor can, in fact, mean that for group one individuals, you tend to see them under one experimental condition than group, and group two, a different one, because of the role of these other factors. And these other factors are known as confounding factors. They're, in a sense, joint causes of the exposure you see in real life and the outcome you see. So the idea here, in that case, is you'd have the sex of an individual, that causing their coffee drinking and also causing their pancreatic cancer. And that's going to induce one of these situations where you see certain types of people under certain experimental conditions because of their sex. That when you look at the 2x2 table that we've just been looking at, it tends to look like there's an association or not, depending on which way it goes. And as I showed you in the two examples, it can be an odds ratio can go off to infinity or it can go to zero, depending on what exposure condition you actually get to see. So unfortunately, we've got two things now that we've come. One is there is a scenario where, in fact, life is great and the information you get from just observing people as they, with one experimental condition available to you, in other words, real life, where that information does, in fact, reflect and translate immediately into what you would see if you saw both, the causal information, and that's randomization. And that's the randomization, and that leads to what's known as the randomization assumption, which is a broader set of conditions than just pure randomization, where you're tossing a coin. So the randomization says the probability of observing a specific exposure condition, so the probability that you are a coffee drinker or not, does not depend on your group membership. So which one you pick for your life, or someone picks for you, does not vary as you go down those group one, group two, group three, group four, those labels that you have. It's not allowed to be influenced by the future. That's the randomization assumption. And if that's the case, then in fact, the information you get from a single observation under one condition, that information can then be used to infer the information, the causal information you would get if you saw people under both conditions. And here's the second point that we've learned, is that how can the randomization assumption fail? And here I just said it slightly differently. If group one individuals are more likely to be males than group four individuals, because males get, in this case I was thinking correctly, males get pancreatic cancer at a higher rate. So there's more males in group one than in group four. And if males are also more likely to drink coffee, then we're more likely to observe the coffee drinking counterfactual in group one than group four. Remember, group one was the people who always get pancreatic cancer under both conditions, and group four is the ones who never get it under either conditions. And that messes things up in the way I described. And that means in that situation, and that's quite plausible, in fact, to hear, is it's actually known that men get pancreatic cancer more often. So there are, if I did know everyone's counterfactual and could label ones around the room, it's much more likely that if there are any poor one ones in here, people who get pancreatic cancer, it's much more likely they're male in this room. And then if you also make this assumption that men are slightly more likely to drink coffee, you're in trouble. And the results you get from the data we get to observe down on Earth has nothing to do with what we could see were we able to observe both counterfactuals. So and here's the world I was getting at. Imagine a world where, in this case, I've changed it. Only males get to drink coffee. So you have to put that that's water, right? Yeah. It's coffee. You have to put it down. It's verboten. You're not allowed. Yeah. A world where only males drink coffee. And then what you're seeing here amongst, and all of them drink coffee, then what you're seeing in the coffee drinking is really a proxy for sex, right? They're all males and only males, and the non-drinkers are all the females. I don't know of a good, I'd probably say something horribly sexist if I picked another example, which is only males do and something only females do. Maybe there is such a thing that one of you can think of so that I don't get into trouble. What was it? What was it?
Menstruate.
Yeah. Well, of course, that would, or have pancreas, or have a, I was on the phone to a lawyer and I was talking about prostate cancer and I was using an example, I was using prostate cancer and saying, well, if you put women in the sample, you're going to reduce the rates of prostate cancer because it's impossible. And he says, what do you mean it's impossible for women to get prostate cancer? This was a lawyer, very high paid lawyer. I said, well, women don't have a prostate. He said, really? So, but then you'd see whatever, and then if it happened that males have, for completely unrelated reasons, higher rates of pancreatic cancer, you'll see an apparent association because the coffee drinking exposure we see is only males. You'll see a higher rate of incidence of pancreatic cancer amongst the coffee drinkers than in the not. It's nothing to do with coffee drinking. It's just that variable sex has determined which of the exposure conditions you tend to see. And you always see coffee drinking for males and the abstaining for females. And so even if coffee had no effect, we would observe an association. And that's what the technical language we use is we say sex is a confounder then of the association. And so this is, I'm not going to be here, but okay. So this is the situation then. On Wednesday, Paul will pick up about, well, how do you deal with this? Given that in this situation where you've got a variable like that, that you know about, how can you get back to making some causal statements? And we'll talk about that on Wednesday.